Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of May 14th, 2010. If you want to have an enjoyable and worry-free retirement, it makes sense to plan ahead, set money aside, invest some for the future. Of course, that means you have to have money to begin with. No one knows that more than folks on Skid Row.
I tell them all the time, look, if you save $5, you did more than you did yesterday. Watch and see how good you'll feel in 5 months when you have 25.
So we can all agree on the need for saving. But spending money on music, that's not so clear cut.
When I see people downloading music illegally, I get the same kind of feeling in my stomach that happens if I see somebody stealing.
We'll have a look at why we pay for or pirate tunes. But first, let's all take a deep breath. A week without stock market mayhem. You know, we talked about dealing with the big plunge on last week's show, but nobody really knew what happened. So we decided to wait. Meanwhile, you wrote in with questions like this one from Tom McCoy in Burnsville, Minnesota. How large does the computer share of the market have to get before it ceases to be a market and becomes a sophisticated computer game? And this one from Oscar Ramos in San Diego. If the stock market is so out of control that years of gains can be wiped out in one day, doesn't it make more sense to just put all your money into paying off your mortgage? Yeah, maybe. So here we are a week later. You've got questions, and we've got, frankly, few answers. Our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, has been looking into one specific aspect of what happened on May 6th. Here's what he found.
We've all heard the phrase, all bets are off. At a casino, the dealer might cancel any wagering should a card accidentally fall to the floor or if the marble jumps out of a roulette wheel. When Wall Street seemed to lose its marbles the other day, leaders of some of the major exchanges came up with their own rule. Some bets are off, but others will stand, even if they too might well have been swayed by a technical glitch that nobody seems to be able to explain.
As a careful investor, as a conscientious investor, it makes me want to run for the doors.
Rochelle Ridmaster is a scientist who lives near Boulder, Colorado.
I was at work, and the whole thing kind of came and went before I even knew it. I came home, was listening to Marketplace, and said, oh, here we go again with these crazy glitches.
It was only when she checked with her financial advisor that Ridmaster learned Wall Street's crazy glitch had cost her big time. She lost thousands of dollars when the sudden plunge triggered a stop loss order. Her stock was then automatically sold once it dropped below a predetermined price.
In a day of legitimate trading, what's fair is fair. And if I ended up having my stock sold, then what's fair is fair.
What's not fair, she complains, is blaming a technical glitch, but then canceling only trades deemed 60% or more out of whack. Ridmaster says all trades during that time should be erased. New York lawyer Bill Singer represents investors in claims against Wall Street brokerages and exchanges. He says they've rigged the game.
You can place a buy order, you can place a sell, but we're not sure we're going to necessarily honor it. We'll see how the market does today, and we'll let you know later.
Not everyone is so sympathetic. James Angel is a leading professor of finance at Georgetown University. He suggests reversing too many trades would reward investors for their own bad decisions.
They had to draw the line somewhere. It's a messy process, and what it shows is that we need to prevent these kind of problems from occurring in the first place.
Angel says there could still be losers, even if all trades during that time were canceled. What about some buyers who might have snapped up shares and then sold them after the market recovered, only to find themselves on the hook for a sale they can't back up?
Somebody thinks, hallelujah, I just bought some stock cheap, and then they sell the stock to pocket their profit. Then the exchange says, oops, sorry, that first trade was a mistake, and they cancel the buy order, but not the sell order. Uh-oh, he sold stock, but he hasn't bought any. Oops.
Angel worries that could make buyers who rushed in and helped the market recover this time hesitate to get burned again, which could lead to a lack of buyers and a sustained crash if it happens again. And Wall Street attorney Bill Singer says that's exactly the point.
When some third party arbitrarily decides to take my profit or to impose a loss upon me, I've lost confidence in the market. And the more people who lose confidence in any market, the less people that are in that market. The more illiquid it becomes, and the more risky it becomes.
All this uncertainty, Singer warns, is doing more and lasting damage to the whole financial system.
That's Marketplace's Bob Moon reporting, and he's still with us here in the studio. And Bob, I think we wanted to take this out to a bit of a broader view of what happened.
Yeah.
First and foremost is this question of whether we have an explanation for what happened. And I think still, a week and a half later, the answer is no.
The head of the SEC, Mary Schapiro, was before Congress saying, we don't know what happened. We're still looking. They have literally millions of electronic trades to go back through. They are already working on a fix, even though they don't know exactly what happened, which sounds a little backwards to
me.
But they want to impose these market-wide circuit breakers that would kick in when a stock falls by a certain level.
Well, you know, on this show, we try not to get too hung up on daily market gyrations, but this was 1,000 points in a mere few minutes. And I think it makes you wonder why anyone should have their money invested in something that can go completely haywire at a moment's notice.
Some of the people I spoke to this week said, listen, if you can't sleep at night, then you shouldn't be investing. That, of course, speaks to investing your money with either the experts, somebody who can advise you more professionally, and you really have to diversify your portfolio. Where have you heard that before,
yeah,
Tess?
Yeah, every week.
And you also have to think long term. And we have seen the market recover almost all of its losses from May 6 in just the past few days, and so we're back basically to where we were.
But I think there is still this sense of unease that we as investors, particularly those of us who are only in the market with 401ks, with 529 college plans, that we really have absolutely no control over the system.
Well, there has been a renewed debate to increase regulation, particularly of these big investors who basically go into the back room and do their trading in the back room with not a lot of transparency. And we don't know exactly what effect that might be having on the market at any given moment.
Some of the reaction to this has been, wait a minute, what does this mean for the economy? Does this mean that the market's rise over the last year or so has been a bit of a head fake and that there really isn't anything underpinning some of the positive feeling that we've had because the market has been on such a tear?
Well, let me underscore that we think that what happened on May 6th was an aberration, was a technical glitch, and is not likely to happen again. On the other hand, I can't vouch for just how deep this market recovery is. I can tell you that trading volume has been uncharacteristically thin.
So that means that not a lot of people
Not
trading.
A lot of people have been trading. And when not a lot of people trade, it can move the market up or down in big jolts. So you have to keep that in mind as you're watching this stock market.
And you should expect for this roller coaster just to continue?
Fasten your seatbelts.
All right. So I think the lesson here is take a Xantax or a Xanax, maybe both.
Might be a good idea, Tess.
All right. Our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, thanks so much.
Thanks.
The new healthcare law has been parsed over pretty thoroughly at this point, but one piece of it has gotten scant attention. It's called the CLASS Act. Stands for Community Living Assistance Services and Supports. It really boils down to a national plan for long-term care insurance. And if you're thinking that long-term care isn't really something you need to worry about, well, our healthcare reporter Gregory Warner is here to explain why you should. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Tess.
So let's start with the basics. Define long-term care for us. What does that mean?
Long-term care basically means help with the activities of daily living, like bathing, dressing, getting in and out of bed, and using the toilet. Of 10 million Americans who now need long-term care, only about 60% are over 65. So we're talking about people who become disabled, both old and young.
Well, that's interesting because I think a lot of people, when they think of long-term care, think, oh, that's something I'm going to need when I get old.
Well, exactly. I mean, a lot of people have the attitude, oh, this doesn't apply to me. I'm not going to need that for another 40 years. And speaking for myself, I mean, I don't have long-term care insurance,
right,
even though it was offered through my job. I talked to Steve Edelstein of PHI. They're an organization that advocates for home care aid workers. He says the older people are when they sign up for long-term care insurance, the higher the premiums.
People don't even start thinking about it until they're in their 60s. And at that point, they're just too close to the age of potentially needing it, that it costs thousands and thousands of dollars.
Thousands of thousands of dollars. That, I would think, would be what would keep people from getting on this kind of program. So let's talk a little bit about what this piece of the healthcare reform law does to fix that situation.
So now the government's passed a national long-term care insurance program. It's called the CLASS Act. And enrollment likely begins in around 2013. The key feature here is that it's an opt-out program. So if you're making enough money to pay Social Security taxes, you will automatically be enrolled. The big question is how much people will pay in premiums, and we're still waiting for the White House to tell us exactly how much. The Congressional Budget Office estimated that average premiums are around $123 a month, but of course there's a big difference between how old you are when you sign up and how many Americans actually join in.
So is this one of those pieces of insurance where the younger you join it, perhaps the less your premiums are going to be, but you still get the same benefit?
Exactly, because the younger you are when you start, the more money you'll contribute before you finally need it. The payout that's expected, it will be something like a minimum of $50 a day or maybe $75 a day.
$50 or $75 a day, you know, if you're truly disabled, how far is $50 going to get you?
Well, if you need full-time care, it doesn't get you far. A home health care aide gets paid about 10 bucks an hour. So if you were to get this $50, say, and put it toward home care, a home care aide only, you'd get 5 hours. So someone to come over in the morning, help you, say, get out of bed, maybe make a meal. Those 5 hours could be the difference between going to a nursing home and being able to stay at home.
But, you know, I have to say, in a nursing home, you would expect that there's some basic level of care. But when you're talking about millions of Americans hiring home care workers, who is watching that store?
Well, exactly. I mean, right now, home care aid workers, this is a low-paid job. And yet, this is a huge business. I mean, we spend $80 billion in this country on some 3 million home care workers. And the legislation that we're talking about is supposed to now create a personal care advisory panel to basically advocate for more training, decent wages, and more regulation of the industry.
Now, how would this work? How would these payments be doled out then? Is the government then giving out checks?
The government basically gives you a check, which then you spend. And you can even actually hire a family member, which could be great for family members who don't have to then choose between going to work and caring for a parent. Of course, at the same time, there's a big potential for fraud.
Right.
I should mention, though, you can't hire your spouse because apparently the pledge to be there in sickness and health extends to long-term care.
All right. Marketplace's Gregory Warner speaking with us about the new CLASS Act. This is part of the healthcare reform law that's going to provide long-term care benefits. Thanks so much for the help.
Thanks, Tess.
Shelling out 25 bucks for checked luggage is painful, and that fee doesn't even guarantee that the bag will arrive at your destination. So if you're tempted to fight back, you will love the story of one man who did.
So I went to small claims court, and I filed a lawsuit against United Airlines, and I simply asked for my $25 back.
That's coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it's time once again for your questions. Helping us out this week is David Lazarus of the Los Angeles Times. Welcome back.
Thank you.
I have to ask you about an article that you wrote recently that I just found fascinating about transportation here in Los Angeles, which, of course, I think many people would assume involves cars, right?
The most car-happy place on the planet, you could say. Yeah,
right.
Indeed.
But you had to take your car into the shop. And so you decided to do an experiment and take public transportation for, what, a week?
Yeah, a week in this case. It's not the first time I've done this. And every time I do it, the takeaway is consistently, why are they making this so hard and so uncomfortable if the goal is to expand ridership?
And what you talked about is that, for example, if you want to buy a weekly pass, that's not possible.
Many people travel great distances to get to and from work. In other words, you're almost certainly going to be going from one thing to another, whether it's a bus to a bus to a subway, system to a system. The trick, it seems to me, is making it absolutely seamless in allowing people to navigate such a system. And yet, in Southern California, for example, you can get your Easy Pass, which allows you to go from system to system, $70 a month. Can you buy it on a weekly basis? No. Can you buy it on a daily basis? No. Are you kidding me?
Did you turn some heads with this? You think it'll get any better?
I'm happy to say that when I talked to transit officials, not just in L.A., but some of the surrounding environs, they all said to me, God, we really appreciate you calling attention to this and saying the things that we don't really get to say a lot in public.
Hmm.
But is there going to be more of a concerted vision to expand public transportation, not just in California, but elsewhere throughout the nation? That's the real trick. And I think at this point, no one's really articulated that vision.
Well, as far as I know, there are no subways in Nebraska.
I would hope there aren't, because that doesn't seem like good subway territory, not a good use of resources.
Well, let's go to Nebraska, and Alicia is on the line with us from the city of Gordon. Hi, Alicia.
Hello.
What do you do there in Nebraska?
Well, I stay at home with my kids currently, and I help market my family's all-natural beef that we sell. And then my husband also works on a ranch that raises beef cattle.
You must be having quite a time of it these days with folks talking about, you know, eating local and eating organic and natural.
Yeah, business has been pretty good so far. It's people are really becoming aware of what they eat, which is good for us. So,
are you a mail order like the Omaha Steaks we all know about?
Sort of, yes, yes. Omaha Steaks is sort of a swear word for us.
Oh.
But actually, that's what we do. Yes, we sell directly from our ranch. Like, literally, if you drive to our ranch, you can buy beef there. But we also have a website, phone number. We take a lot of calls for beef orders and a lot of internet orders.
Well, David, I don't know about you. Something has always struck me as kind of weird about sending meat through the mail.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, the idea of ordering beef by the mail, I just wouldn't do it.
So disabuse us of this, Alicia.
Well, we pack it on dry ice, and we don't ship any longer than 2 days. But it's always frozen when it reaches you. So it would be just like buying it through the frozen aisle at a supermarket.
Yeah, okay. Except I get home from the supermarket in 15 minutes. That's the difference.
Yeah, yeah, but ours is much, much better. I will say that.
All right. Well, enough about beef. I believe you wrote in about credit cards, right? You had a question there?
Well, what I do, and it's not with typical revolving credit card. It's with a store credit, like a Target card or a Kohl's card, for a couple examples. And what I'll do is, when I'm shopping there that day, most of those stores have a deal where if you sign up for their card, you can get 10% off your purchases for that day. I sign up for the card, and then I immediately go over to customer service and pay off my balance. And then when my statement arrives in the mail, I just immediately cancel the card because I don't want to be carrying it around.
Well, David, this certainly sounds like a great way to try to game the system as a consumer. But what is this going to do to her credit score if she's opening these cards and then automatically closing them right away?
A lot of consumers play the same game that Alicia's playing. In fact, my wife also does it, and she, for the same exact reasons, and that is they're offering these discounts. They look very attractive, and so you want to jump at it. I tell everybody, when it comes to store credit cards, it's not a game you want to play. And let me run it
down.
You
tell your wife that, too?
Big time. Does she listen to me? That's a whole other thing. But, you know, here it is. You're weighing the pros and cons. And the upside is you're getting that immediate discount. The downside, however, is very large. For example, most store credit cards come with an APR, an interest rate of 20% or more.
But she's paying it off.
All right, but that's Alicia. That's not everybody. That's, okay, First of all, your first thing. But here's the biggie that Alicia's calling about. What does it do to your credit score?
Mm-hmm.
The simple fact is, any time you apply for new plastic, it creates a ding on your credit score, meaning you now suddenly represent a greater risk to everybody, and your credit score will go down as a result.
Alicia, have you looked at your credit score?
I did look at it, and it was frightening. Like, there was a list of anything I've ever signed up for.
Yeah.
I just don't think the short-term gain outweighs the potential demerits of having a credit record that shows more activity or more risk than you might actually represent. You just want to stay away from store credit. It's just not worth your time.
So, Alicia, all this is very practical stuff, but I think you also mentioned the word ethics when you first mentioned this, right?
Yeah, I did. And it's kind of an oxymoron when you say credit card companies and ethics.
Right.
I don't think there's any ethical consideration whatsoever. I think the credit card companies, it's not like these guys, you know, are going to church on Sunday and repenting their ways. No, they are in business. And for anybody who thinks that they can pull a fast one on the credit card companies, you'll still sleep well at night. The whole question is about you, and you want to protect that person.
All right.
So there you go, Alicia. It's all about you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for the call.
All right. Thank you.
If you've got questions, and we know you do, do give us a call. We're here to help you out with your life with dollar signs. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can always write us an email. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. All right, let's go to Bob. He is from Apalachicola, Florida. Hi, Bob.
How are you doing?
I'm very well. And you?
I'm doing just great. Nice day.
I know you're a truck driver. Can I assume that you are not in Apalachicola?
No, right now I am just outside of Louisville, Kentucky.
Hey, can I ask a question? I've got satellite radio in my car, and I've always been curious to ask a trucker, do you guys listen to the trucker channels?
Trucker channels.
Trucker channels, which are totally cool, but they don't. I'm not their demographic, so I wanted to talk to somebody who actually is. Do you guys listen to this stuff when you are on the road?
Yes, because if we find one that we like on the radio, regular radio, we'll be out of the area of that signal in about 45 minutes, and we have to search through the radio again to find something else we like. Satellite, we can listen to it from coast to coast and never have to lose a signal.
But what is on the trucker channel?
They have some that are predominantly country with talk radios, weather updates, road closures.
The feeling I always got was it was like having somebody in the passenger seat with you hanging out for the long stretch that you'd want to hang out with, kind of like me and Tess.
What do you think, Bob? Should we have a Marketplace Money Trucker channel?
I do believe there would be a niche for it.
All right.
A very little niche. But
So do truckers manage their money well?
Some do. The ones that stay in business longer than 6 months, they have.
Yeah, there you go. And how long have you been in business?
About 20 years now.
20 years. That is a lot of time on the road. How much time out of the year are you on the road?
Usually anywhere from 50 weeks down to about 42 weeks if I take it real slow.
Well, so those other 2 weeks out of the year, you live in Apalachicola?
Yes, ma'am. I live on a little sailboat in Apalachicola, yeah.
Boy, did I miss my calling. I want Bob's life. This sounds so nice.
What's that like to go from basically sitting for 50 weeks out of the year and then going onto a sailboat where you're bobbing up and down?
Space is at a, to put it politely, extreme minimum in a sailboat. Everyone, when they hear, oh, you live on a sailboat, that is so nice. It's an extremely romantic idea. In actual practice, I tell them if they want to know what it's like, flood their basement and move everything they have into the closet.
Well, so if you want to get off the sailboat, where do you want to go?
Well, I grew up in South Texas, and I've been thinking of settling back down there. And now that the housing market, this bubble I keep hearing about, has supposedly popped and interest rates are going to stay low for a little bit longer, if somebody who has never owned a home, would this be a good time to actually start seriously looking at buying a home?
Well, David, I would say, first of all, that I'm really glad to hear that there are at least some questions going on here. There's a little bit of caution because I have to say, even after the spectacular collapse of the housing market, we have been surprised by how little caution there is out there.
Bob isn't alone in what he's facing. I get asked this a lot about whether this is the right time to get in. And I think the real trick, first of all, is making sure you're asking yourself the right question. The question isn't, is this the right time in market terms? Because the answer is going to be yes. The right question that people like Bob want to be asking, though, is this the right time for me?
Right. And Bob, is that you?
I hope so. I'm afraid that I'm going to get in over my head quick with not taking my time to look at all angles. And that's what I'm trying to do right now, is look at every angle and find out where I can possibly go wrong and fix it before it ever happens.
Well, and let me ask you this, a bit of a philosophical question, which is, if you are on the road 42 to 50 weeks a year, why do you feel like you want to have the responsibility of a house?
I think it's more along the lines of putting roots down somewhere.
Hmm.
Traveling all over the U.S. for 20 years, it'd be nice to know that I have some place that I can always go back to.
Right.
Well, let me tell you something, Bob. As a homeowner, this isn't the kind of investment that you want to make that you then aren't observing and monitoring on a regular basis. And so if you were spending weeks, even months, away from your home and you had nobody there looking after it, it's a recipe for trouble. I would just say that at this point, considering your lifestyle, the smart play might be putting money aside into a money market fund or some other relatively safe investment. Build that nest egg steadily, steadily, steadily until you're ready for a lifestyle change. And when you are, suddenly you're going to find yourself in a very good position to make the plunge into the housing market.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. If the housing market picks up and the prices go beyond where I'm comfortable, I can always use that to purchase a larger boat for the Bahamas.
Oh, well, I don't think that sounds like a bad idea at all.
You'll have Tess and me there in a second when we're done with our mail order meet. And also, hey, here's another thing too, Bob. The housing market, it goes up, it goes down. Anyone who tries to time the market is playing a fool's game. Even if we go into another bubble, what happens to bubbles? They pop. So not to worry.
Well, great call. Thanks for calling in, Bob. And I have to do this. 10-4, good buddy.
Looks like we got us a convoy. Oh, sorry.
Thank you for answering my call, and y'all keep it between the ditches.
Oh, I like that one, too.
I like that, too,
I'm
yeah.
going to start using that.
Put the pedal to the metal.
All right, thanks so much, Bob.
Y'all have a good day.
Bye-bye.
We is heading for Bear on I-10, about a mile out of Shaky Town. I says, Pigpen, this here's a rubber duck, and I'm about to put the hammer down.
All right, well, let's go to Mindy, and she is on the line from San Antonio, Texas. Hi, Mindy.
Hi.
You recently got engaged, right?
Yes.
And as we know, David, relationships come with all kinds of financial baggage.
Oh, God, yes. And one of the biggest financial plans you're going to put together is bringing another person into your life.
What have you and your fiancé been doing in terms of talking about how you're going to merge your money?
I don't know. We're just trying to get a lot of things on track right now, especially with this car situation.
The car situation? Is this your financial baggage?
Well, in a previous relationship he was in, he co-signed on a car for his girlfriend at the time, and she couldn't make her payments. So it pretty much destroyed his credit to where we can't even get a house right now or anything like that.
Uh-oh.
And so we had to go and take the car from her, and we've been making the payments ever since.
Is she not making payments on it anymore?
She was paying it every now and then, but it was always over 30 days late, over 60 days late.
And so the bank was knocking at your fiance's door.
Exactly. And it was just horrible. We were getting calls every day and trying to contact her and see if she would pay it. And she's just an unreasonable person. So we've been paying on it ever since.
Well, I got to say, Mindy, this reminds me a lot of a certain daytime favorite.
Like sand through the hourglass, so are the days of our lives.
Yes. We are in a financial soap opera here.
Yes. It's like this every day for us, it seems like.
Oh, no.
But we're not letting it get us down. We're working through it. I'm not, like, upset at him for anything that he did with his past.
So what have you done so far to try to remedy this situation?
We went and took it from her once, and her dad had to get involved because apparently she's just immature and can't deal with her life on her own. So her dad was making the payments. Then he stopped making the payments. So then we had to take it again. And so now we're making the payments. She's not getting it back. Finally got her address, and we sent her a letter seeing if she would cooperate with the sale of the vehicle. And, I mean, that's just as far as we've gone. So we just don't know what we can do.
All right. Well, lucky for you, I have Jerry Springer here with me in the room.
Oh, insult me, why don't you? Sorry, Jerry, if you're listening. Didn't mean that. I also think you played the soap opera music a little too soon.
I think I did. It got
really
worse.
Bubbled up after that.
Jeepers.
I got two things right off the bat. First of all, Mindy, if this is the worst baggage in your fiancé's past, you're ahead of the game. Second, for everybody, don't co-sign alone. All right, so what do you do? Talk the ex-girlfriend into refinancing. And that's basically you're going to refi the loan, you're going to change the terms of the loan, and when that happens, guess who is going to be gone as a co-signer? That's your best possible scenario here.
But, David, how likely is it that she's going to be able to refi a loan that she hasn't been paying on?
I think she's going to be in a lot of trouble about it, but through the refi process, it's possible that the lender is going to see through this whole soap opera. The lender doesn't want you walking away from the loan. The lender does not want you filing for bankruptcy protection. The lender doesn't want anything like that. So if they see all the contours of this soap opera, it's possible the lender is going to then create terms that are going to be palatable to everybody, not least of which the ex-girlfriend.
Yeah, it's certainly the most equitable way to think about it. But boy, when I think from the bank's perspective, I would not want to get off the hook the person who has been paying and the person who is financially responsible.
All right. So if I'm the fiancé in this case, what I am doing is writing letters to the lender saying, guess what? I'm about to file a lawsuit because I am not happy with this circumstance. I am not a part of her life. Mm. And you're going to face all sorts of troubles that you don't want to face. Take it up a level. Yeah. That's the only thing that the big banks understand is when you play a little tough.
Hey, Mindy, have you been playing tough at all yet?
Not really. We're just, every time we try to get help, no one will help us. No one wants to talk to us.
Let me give you a tip there, Mindy. What you want to do is contact a licensed credit counselor. There are a number of licensed credit counselors. You can find them online. Do a search for, I believe it's the National Federation of Credit Counselors.
Yep.
And these guys can mediate a situation like this and perhaps lead you and lead the lender out of the thicket.
Okay.
So, Mindy, let me turn the tables on you and ask if perhaps you have any advice for folks who are thinking of co-signing a loan with a boyfriend or a girlfriend.
Don't do it.
There you go.
Mindy learns fast.
Yes. All right. So you have your marching orders.
Thank you. I appreciate all your help.
Otherwise, you can make your fiancé live on a sailboat.
All right. Thanks for the call, Mindy, and good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You can give us a call at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or email your question. You can do that with the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. David Lazarus, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks for coming in.
Always a pleasure.
And remember to check with your financial expert before making any big money decisions. One of the most common questions we get from you, dear listener, is how on earth are you supposed to save money each month when everything you earn is going toward bills? The answer, of course, is usually all about choices. Take a hard look at your spending habits. Make savings a priority. Think you can't do it? Are you sure?
Some kind of patient.
The students in Renee Wyatt's money management class are learning how. And everything you're about to hear should sound very, very familiar.
This month's topic is budgets, financial goals, and tracking your spending. But before we get started, let's everybody go around and introduce yourself and say what you want to get out of this class for this month.
My name is Stephanie, and I'd like to learn how to budget.
Hi, my name is Brian, and what I would like to get out of this class is how to make the most out of my money.
My name is Alan, and I would like to get out of this
class. As they went around the room, the refrain was one we can all recognize. I want to know where my money is going. I want to save more. Gosh, sounds like our listener Colin from 5 minutes ago.
The most important part of budgeting is tracking your money. If you take out your flyer and turn to the first part of it, we're going to talk about where does your money go? So, how many are tired of living from paycheck to paycheck?
All 15 hands went up. But before you think this is another story about a money management class, there's a twist here. These people are being asked to save, even though their income totals somewhere between $200 and $900 a month. The students in this classroom are also clients here at Lamp Community, a homeless shelter on Skid Row in Los Angeles.
It's pretty amazing how our folks do get by, you know, and do pay for all the things that they need to pay for on that income. They're survivors.
Shannon Murray is the shelter's acting executive director.
We found that money management really helps in providing additional stability to people that are getting off the street and getting into their own apartments.
LAMP's mission is to transition homeless men and women, most of whom are also dealing with serious mental illness, into permanent housing. That means that clients, like 34-year-old Tiffany, have to learn how to allocate a portion of their Social Security and disability checks for expenses.
Well, I came to class because I'm budgeting now since I got my own place and dealing with a lot of things. I'm trying to learn how to budget so that I will be able to depend on my money anytime I need it instead of around the 1st to the 15th.
Tiffany is bipolar, the mother of 6 children, including a 9-month-old boy, and she spent 2 months living in the shelter before getting an apartment through LAMP. Now, about half of her $900 a month disability check goes toward rent.
I try to hold on to the little bit that I do have left.
Do you have any savings?
Maybe a little bit over 100.
For this month?
Yes, for this month.
Tiffany, she's a miracle.
That's class instructor Renee Wyatt again. She's head of LAMP's money management program, which also serves as a bank for the shelter's clients.
Tiffany lived on the streets for a long time. She used to run in here, cuss me out, screaming and hollering, "Give me my money! You can't tell me what to do!" And now her life has changed.
Not just because she has a handle on her finances, of course. But what advocates like Wyatt have found is that when people like Tiffany, or for that matter any of us, are able to take control of their money habits, that can lead to progress and control in other areas of their lives.
So this is a sample budget worksheet. If you are spending more than you earn, you have a deficit. In other words, you're in the red, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you have to look for ways to cut back or to earn more income.
Wyatt's class is remarkable for its simple lesson that the basics of finance are the same, whether you're rich or poor. Another client, 40-year-old Brian, was homeless off and on for about 5 years and now lives on Social Security payments. He's been through all of Wyatt's classes, from credit cards to insurance and budgeting.
To help me make my money last all month long instead of it gone in a couple weeks.
It's a difficult thing to do.
Yeah. It made me focus on more realistic goals, short-term goals and long-term goals.
He would never last through the month.
Renee Wyatt says Brian is one of her biggest success stories.
And recently, in the middle of the month, he asked me what his balance was, and I would say, like, $279. And his eyes would get big, and it's the middle of the month, and I still have money, Miss Renee. And he was so excited. He said, "I love my budget. I'm going to do it again next month."
And he did.
So this is what we're going to do right now. It says, write down your wishes for the future. These can be things you want today, next week, or 20 years from now.
The wishes around the table ranged from getting an apartment or paying off a loan to high hopes of, eventually, a house, a car, and a dog. Aspirations common to so many of us and made real by common and relatively simple advice.
That is like my dream for each individual person, that they will come into a knowing that they don't have to live from paycheck to paycheck. You know, I tell them all the time, look, if you save $5, you did more than you did yesterday. Watch and see how good you'll feel in 5 months when you have 25. It'll make you want to save even more. Try it, you know.
So you still think you can't do it? Are you sure? And we have links to the materials used in Renee Wyatt's class at marketplace.org. You don't ever want to get a letter from a media company ordering you to cease and desist your illegal downloading. Trust me. Not that I'd ever do such a thing, but certain members of my household think it's downright silly to pay for things you can get online for free, like season 4 of Friday Night Lights before it aired on NBC. And in fact, if you turn the argument on its head, why are millions of people still paying for the same music and movies they could get for free? It's a question that prompts us to ask.
Let me start with question number 1. What the hell were you thinking?
What were you thinking? It's our look at why we do what we do with our money. Joel Rose explores the decision to pay or pirate.
My friend Katie went to college in the late 1990s when just about everyone she knew was using Napster or something like it to download music. But Katie never did.
It's simplistic to just sort of go to the do not steal defense. But I do feel like when I see people downloading music illegally, I get the same kind of feeling in my stomach or my psyche or whatever it is that happens if I see somebody stealing.
Katie still doesn't have to look very far to see someone downloading music without paying for it. Her husband, Al.
Well, the equation for me at this point is, you know, I have more time than money.
Al has accumulated thousands of MP3s over the years, from hip-hop to obscure surf rock from the 1950s. He thinks record labels ripped consumers off for decades, so he doesn't feel a lot of remorse about their current woes.
The reason that we have this predicament, right, is because information is sort of naturally fighting to be free. It's naturally like trying to escape the gatekeepers.
I mean, maybe that's why you don't have that feeling of guilt that I have. Because that's like underlying your sort of logic.
Yeah, that's good. That's good, Dr. Freud. Yeah, that's good.
Neither Al nor Katie seems all that worried about the legal consequences. Of course, they don't want us to use their last names because they know the recording industry spent years suing people for illegal downloading. But in the end, those lawsuits haven't done much to alter their behavior.
I think it's about the same as being afraid of being struck by lightning, you know? You weigh the risks and you move forward, I guess.
If you think that there's not much chance that you'll be caught, it's not necessarily a factor that will make someone change their behavior.
Jean-Francois Ouellette teaches marketing at HEC Montreal. He says there are some consumers who always pay for music and others who never pay. And in between, there are lots of listeners who decide on a case-by-case basis.
It's all about how people feel about the artist. People will download for free whatever music comes from the big-ticket artists, such as U2 or Madonna, for example. But when it comes to local artists, usually they'll say that those people are worth encouraging.
But the whole notion of collecting MP3 files on your computer or iPod may soon go the way of the 8-track. That's because streaming services like Rhapsody and Pandora are gaining in popularity. These are companies that store millions of songs on their hard drives. Listeners can access them online through their computers and mobile phones.
You know, if that can convince people to pay a certain number of dollars per month for a service like that that stores everything in the proverbial cloud, the industry would actually make a lot more money.
Elliot Van Buskirk blogs about the music business at Wired.com. He says consumers have shown they want access to lots of music, even on their mobile devices, and some may be willing to pay a monthly fee for it.
Both purchasing and stealing music will become seen as a waste of disk space, you know, in the best case scenario for the industry.
Streaming may work for some consumers. My friend Katie says she would think about it, but Al, not so much. He wants to be sure he can play his songs wherever and whenever he wants.
I like having a copy and being able to use it in whatever way I want. I want it for myself.
He just doesn't want to, you know, pay for it. In Philadelphia, I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace Money.
Time once again for your comments, compliments, and, oh yes, complaints. You had more than a few of those after our last What Were You Thinking segment. It was all about investors who were so freaked out by last year's stock market collapse that they sold all their shares and never got back in. That, of course, is the opposite of buy low, sell high, and the opposite of rational investing. But some of you, including William Creed of New York City, asked instead, what were we thinking?
This story was poorly done. It assumes that anyone who bailed out of the market after it started to tank was foolish or irrational. The end of 2008 and into early 2009, no one knew if the market would recover or collapse completely.
And Susan Adler of Basking Ridge, New Jersey, really let us have it.
How dare you scold people for selling? How do you know that the current upswing isn't herd mentality? Should we have held because stocks were undervalued? Should we hold now because they're still undervalued? I only wish we had gotten out sooner.
In our defense, one of the most basic bits of advice we repeat time and time again is don't try to time the market, right? Okay, that's not the only story that got your dander up. Last week, we addressed the topic of unemployment benefits and how long the government should provide them. James Shirk of the Heritage Foundation said certain jobs, like those in the auto industry, will never come back, and the key concern should be job creation. Laura Gray lives in Pittsburgh. 2 years ago, she lost her job, and recently she received the last of her unemployment benefits.
I am so tired of hearing people spout rhetoric on job creation as being the immediate answer to this crisis. I have worked my whole life providing for my family, and if I don't find employment soon, we may lose everything. Yes, the goal down the road is job creation, But the immediate needs of those who are victims need to be addressed right now.
And finally, a while back, we explored the decision by Spirit Airlines to charge customers for carry-on luggage. To me, and a lot of other flyers, it seemed like the last straw. Who'd fly an airline that charged for carry-on bags? Kevin Myers of Boston would.
I fly several times a week, and I love this idea.
What?
Since airlines instituted their checked bag fees, every single flight seems to run out of overhead compartment space. Business travelers won't mind paying another $50 or so to be able to get out of the airport quickly, but leisure travelers should be encouraged to check their bags, which would make the security and general travel experience far more pleasant for everyone.
I wonder what he'll say when they start charging for seatbelts. Send your comments to us at marketplace.org. I promise you it is now and always will be free. So back to that whole charge for baggage debate, because I'm not the only one who just can't let it go. Now, I know, we just have to get used to it, right? You bring a bag, you're going to pay a fee. But riddle me this. What exactly do you get for that fee? Don't you at least have an expectation of getting your checked bag back? Well, that is what Dartmouth professor Charles Whelan is asking. Tell us what happened to you.
Well, I arrived from Manchester. I was flying from Toronto to Manchester, and I assumed that my bag would arrive as well. I had, after all, paid my $25 bag check fee, but the next day there was no bag, the next week there was no bag, and now 6 weeks later there's still no bag. So I am asking for my $25 back.
Well, I think most of us would react to this by probably just staying on hold with the airline for days on end, but you did something a little more than that.
Well, first I did the hold on end. I mean, I went through every phone tree branch there is. But after a while, I was so mired in what I began to call phone tree hell that I had to resort to a different option.
And tell us what you did.
So I went to small claims court, and I filed a lawsuit against United Airlines, and I simply asked for my $25 back.
Now, the bag fee was $25, but from what I understand, the cost to actually file the claim is about $72. So what's your point here?
Well, at first glance, it wouldn't seem to make much sense. Turns out that it's actually really important in terms of economics. It's essentially vengeance, and vengeance has a technical definition, which is you're willing to harm yourself in order to impose harm on somebody else. Now, when we do that, what the behavioral psychologists have learned is it makes us feel good. It lights up the pleasurable parts of the brain, just like doing other things that make you feel good. So vengeance might actually be quite rational.
Who knew, right?
Well, I know, because when I drove back from the district court, it was the best I had felt in 6 weeks.
Well, so you feel better, but what are you really hoping to get out of this?
Well, two things. One is I just wanted to signal that this level of customer service is not acceptable. The second is the more serious, which is there's still the missing bag.
Right.
And the second round that we have to go through is what is that stuff worth? And this is kind of sending a small little signal that, you know what, I'm going to fight there too.
The question that you pose is, you know, what can I expect when I'm giving you $25 for my bag? And my basic expectation is that I'm going to get it back. Would you have done anything differently had you not had to pay that fee?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that if I hadn't been charged the $25, then there's no way I could say right now, while they're ostensibly still looking for the bag, hey, at a minimum, you owe me that back. That's the bare minimum I should expect. And if there were no fee like that, I wouldn't have that kind of tangible thing that I could ask for in the interim.
Have you heard back from United? Are you expecting them to show up?
I am expecting a call any day now, and I still haven't got it. The pattern of no contact whatsoever initiated by United persists. They just won't contact me.
Charles Whelan is a professor at the Harris School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago and also a visiting professor currently at Dartmouth College and also the author of the book Naked Economics. Thanks so much. It's been fun talking with you.
Well, thank you. And if you see a black hanging bag with my stuff in it, please send it back to Manchester, New Hampshire.
You got it. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, when it comes to allowance, some things are just worth fighting for.
I don't know. I mean, what you consider wants, I might consider needs. Like makeup. Makeup is definitely a need.
Duh, Mom. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Jolie Myers. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week. There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering new ways for investors to pursue their goals with lower volatility. On the web at putnam.com/absolute return. American Public Media.